You're listening to Well Made. I'm Stefan Ango, co-founder of Lumi. My whole life, I've been asking myself the same question. What does it mean to make things well? This is the show where we talk to creators, entrepreneurs, movers and shakers, people who have become experts in their field and can shed light on that simple question, what makes something well made? Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great. I think you're going to be a regular because I have so many questions for you and I don't think we're going to be able to cover them all.
I think all my life I've wanted to be a regular at something. So I'm all down for that.
Being a
regular. Like a regular at a coffee shop, yeah. A regular at a restaurant, a regular on a podcast. Yeah.
That's funny. I was just talking to Jessie about that the other day and she doesn't want to be a regular. She wants people to treat her like they have never met her before, and maybe that'll give... There's a different experience that you get out of that, but I like being a regular. I want to be able to go to, like a coffee shop or a sushi place. I just walk in the room, and they just start doing everything the way I like it.
It's kind of funny, because I want to be both.
You want to be both.
I want to have a little bit of, mystery, like what Jesse's talking about, perhaps, and then also be, familiar and be a regular.
So for people who are not so familiar with you, there's a whole group of people that nobody knows about that is like making the internet. And you're one of those people. Like, I feel like that is an incredible part of your life that I feel like you should take a lot more credit for. I'm just going to run down some of the places you work. Okay, GeoCities, Yahoo, Etsy, Media Temple, Uncovit, and now Reaction Commerce. All of these places, to me, what's interesting about them is that they're platforms and they're those sort of infrastructural things that make the internet happen. How did you end up doing all of this stuff?
Well, first, you're too kind. I think ultimately at my core, I like building things.
Yeah.
And I think I'm a fixer, I'm an operator, and I kind of fell into tech, literally fell into GeoCities just at the time that it was taking off. I was kind of like, that movie Sliding Doors? I literally was at this point in my life where I was like, I could have gone in one door and been a social worker and then been in another door. And I went down this path of tech. And
you studied psychology, right?
I studied psychology, yes. And I think, if you kind of see the threads throughout my career, it is about teams and team building and community building. At GeoCities, I was a senior community coordinator and really just fell in love with building platforms and building ways for people to communicate or for businesses to be successful.
So what was GeoCities at the time for the people who don't know what it was? To me, it's one of the most important things that happened in the early parts of the web.
This was probably, 97. So you're looking 20 years ago. It was a personal publishing platform. So pre-MySpace, pre-Facebook, ways for people to create websites.
It was the first thing where you could make your own website.
You could make your own website and you could actually place it into a neighborhood. And those neighborhoods were based on themes. And those themes is where all the community and the vibrancy is. So there's a sports neighborhood. There was, a techie neighborhood. And so as a senior community coordinator, we had all these community leaders who were, there's probably thousands of community leaders who were moderating these neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And doing community building, whether it was setting up contests and chats and also doing some enforcement, making sure there was no bad neighbors. And it's interesting because you fast forward to now and you see where Facebook is with building up thousands of moderators for fake news. And it's, similar parallels to where we were 20 years ago, just at a smaller scale. So anyway, that was kind of the genesis of the career. And I just loved it from that very second. It was just amazing to be able to build something that touched millions of people.
How did you fall into that then, coming from psychology?
They were hiring a senior community coordinator, and I was doing community coordinating, but in the offline space. So I was doing community coordinator work within the communities of Los Angeles, and a friend of mine sent me the job description. I was like, wow, this sounds just like you, and you should check into it. And I'd always been, from a very early age, a tinkerer, kind of a fascinated with computers and fascinated with tech and trying to figure things out. And the earliest days of Mac Draw and just early tech. So yeah, that was kind of the
gen- was in Los Angeles? Was GeoCities based in Los Angeles?
GeoCities was based in Los Angeles, yeah. The office, ironically, is about two blocks from my current office, Reaction Commerce.
Really?
Yeah.
Is yeah.
Like and then GeoCities was acquired by Yahoo in the kind of crazy web 1.0 craze for probably $4 billion.
Wow.
In many ways, it was ahead of its time. I mean, it's probably like an early precursor to MySpace and then to Facebook or even to other publishing platforms. And the tools and the technologies just got better, faster, stronger, right? And that's a thread that you just see in almost any industry, whether it's e-commerce or publishing or even outside of tech.
So just to skip ahead, we'll bounce around, we'll come back to other things, but Reaction Commerce, describe what that is.
So Reaction Commerce is a completely open source commerce platform. We're built, everything's real time. It's all reactive. The tech stack is all JavaScript, HTML, CSS. So we're built on modern technologies. And again, going back to what we were just talking about, there's definitely several evolutions at play right now. One is the connected devices evolution. So clearly we're all connected to mobile. And the other is a pretty big shift towards Node and towards JavaScript and React and kind of just more frameworks that make it easier to customize and extend software. And then another evolution I think that we're seeing is towards containers and Docker and making it easier for developers to deploy and customize and extend applications than it used to be, right?
Quickly, I want to give the maybe layman's perspective on it. So Reaction Commerce today is a piece of software that is modular, has a lot of different plugins that you can connect that allows you to make an e-commerce website.
That's exactly right. So an e-commerce website that does everything from catalog management, inventory management, shipping, taxes, order processing, the actual website itself, the shopping cart, the checkout. So we think of ourselves as kind of that end-to-end solution, both the software itself, but also the hosting and the cloud infrastructure for you to run your shop. And
right.
We support both shops and marketplaces. So it's not just single tenant shops. We also support multi-shop experiences.
So you just mentioned something. So you can host it yourself. You can download the software. So as opposed to some of the other ones out there like Shopify, you don't have access to the software.
So, right.
It's more like something like WordPress, which WordPress is a blog platform. You can go to the WordPress.com, which is the version that is hosted by WordPress, and you can create your blog on there. Or you can take the software, download it, modify it, add plugins or whatever, and host it on your own website. So Reaction Commerce has a similar model to that.
Very similar model. Something that I often say to folks is that we are trying to be the WordPress of commerce. Mm-hmm. Anyone can go right now and download Reaction Commerce. It's a GPL license. They can modify it, extend it, customize it, and then run it or deploy it wherever they want. Mm-hmm. But then we have a managed platform, like you were pointing out, which is where our business model is, and that's a monthly recurring kind of platform as a service fee. And then we have other premium apps that we'll be adding on top of that, like analytics and merchandising and promotions.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate in this conversation because...
Bring it on.
I really like what you're doing, but I also think it's kind of crazy to try to do this because... In the blue ocean, red ocean, like model of the world, this is very much a red ocean. There are a lot of companies making software for e-commerce. Shopify is the one that comes to mind. I've used Shopify for many years now. Lumi runs off of our own thing that we built, but there's, BigCommerce and WooCommerce and Magento and all these older, ones that still exist and have a lot of traction with some big companies. There's also tons of people building their own. So there's all these options and you're coming in with a new thing. I'm playing devil's advocate. Why is it a good idea to do this now? Why is there a place for Reaction Commerce today?
Well, it's a great question. So the first thing that came to my mind is everyone that you mentioned, all of today's market leading commerce platforms came out before the launch of the first iPhone. Mm-hmm. So you've just had a big revolution and a shift in how consumers and how businesses behave. And you, in some of those cases, you just wouldn't architect them or build them. Again, going back to GeoCities, you just wouldn't build them today the way they were built a short 10, 12, whatever years ago. So you have that at play. And you also... You know, I think e-commerce is still in its infancy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we've been around it probably our whole careers, but really it's probably still in the first inning, and then there's significant room for growth, especially when you think outside of North America. So we're already internationalized for 25 languages, currency conversion, localization. And I think there is a pretty big hole in the market, especially when you look at like companies that are maybe more ambitious or, mm-hmm. you know, want more customization, want to be able to control their experience a little bit more. And when you start to look at closed source providers who maybe are catering more to the SMB market, once you start to get up to mid-market, especially to enterprise, there's certainly not that many options considering how big the market is. And there's not that many options built on a modern technology stack. So we see there's plenty of room. The other thing I think I love chatting about is that there's no such thing as one size fits all for commerce.
Yeah.
I mean, you could be selling subscription goods. I could be selling rental goods. You could be selling physical goods. I could be selling digital goods. And all of those have different permutations and needs around their customization or their checkout flow. And, or let's get to like logistics. You could have multiple warehouses. I have a single warehouse, taxes. There's just all these different permutations. And so I think by being open source, we're able to have the benefit of the community, mm-hmm. Who's contributing to the code base and actually modifying it and extending it and enhancing it to fit all those different use cases.
Yeah. So the modular nature is part of that and the open source. I mean, I think if we had, you know, the founders of Shopify in the room, they would say like, yeah, you can do that with a plugin. You know, we have all these APIs that you can use. What does having it open source like do for you?
So I think Shopify's, you know, done a tremendous job in terms mm-hmm. of how they've executed. But ultimately, we found that once you start to do meaningful volume, you want more ownership at the core of your code base to be able to customize. And you can hack your way around with APIs or with certain access, but you're still beholden to a company or to someone else to make modifications for you. There's a really great principle. I think it's called Joy's Law, which is attributed to Bill Joy, who's the co-founder of Sun Microsystems. And his quote, the principle is, no matter who you are, the smartest people work for someone else.
Yeah.
And like, I think if we tried to rely just on our employees,
right.
We'd never satisfy our customers because of all those different permutations and that one size doesn't really fit all. So again, I think like for us, for what we want to build, being open source is kind of the only way we can do it. Otherwise, we would die by 1,000 cuts. Like we would die by trying to do a billion different things.
One of the reasons we ended up switching away from Shopify, even though I actually really like Shopify, is there are so many use cases in our particular scenario that were not really ideal for Shopify. For example, we have a number of products that are priced to the 10th or the 100th of a cent. You know, they have 3 decimals or 4 decimals because there's products that we sell that are that inexpensive. You know, we're selling like 1,000 of this very small plastic bag or something like that. And so that's not possible with Shopify. You can't have prices that are
I think
that
that's
low.
Another great use case, right?
Yeah, that's a weird kind of random thing. Or, you know, we have transactions going through our system that are anywhere from $10 to $100,000. And we have to be able to process ACH and credit cards and all these different things.
Right.
And payment terms that people might have where they're paying like 50% upfront or something like that. So all of that, those were weird things that didn't fit in the Shopify model. And that, you know, there was a couple other ones like that that made us decide to build our own thing. But I do think that if Reaction Commerce had been around at the right time for us, we would have probably used it.
Yep.
And our stack is also all JavaScript and React.
Right.
So it would make sense.
No, I think your use case and the way you're describing it is exactly, I think, why we exist and why we make sense, which is one size does not fit all. You have custom needs, you have custom requirements. And we talk to businesses, you know, day in and day out who are at this same juncture. They may be on a legacy solution or an existing platform and they just want to do X. And that X could be, you know, the pricing or it could be the bundling.
It's just one random little thing, but it doesn't fit into the, right. you know, the 90% use case for. So would you say that your users are maybe more advanced or more technical, or their business is at a like higher level?
A little bit of all of that. Yeah. So I think it has to do with their maybe a little bit more technology forward. They want to and understand that investing in technology is really important for their business. They're doing a certain volume. You know, they've reached a point where they are scaling and they're struggling to scale, or they're struggling to get that experience that they want. And then they want to look for, you know, another solution or a new solution. And that's where I think we come into play. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely focused more on that, like call it mid-market towards enterprise customer because of that, because look, you're going to get a pretty powerful platform for that, but you're also going to want to roll up your sleeves. And it doesn't mean you have to have a massive tech team or, you know, a lot of capital to do it. You just, you know, we found that companies with one or two front-end engineers who really want to be working on Node and want to be working on React are perfect, because they come in and they see the platform, they see how extendable it is, and that's what they're looking for.
We're talking a lot about JavaScript. Can you explain for someone who's maybe not as technical, what's going on with programming languages and the web right now?
I can try. So
why is JavaScript important?
So the interesting thing about JavaScript is that it's been around for 18, 19 years. It's kind of one of the earliest languages of the web. And it is also one of the only languages that runs across all connected devices. So it actually runs natively on iPhones.
That's like the most important thing,
it's
right?
The most important thing, which is also why, you know, we are able to support both shops and native applications because of JavaScript. So JavaScript's been around for a really long time. Over in the last, I don't know, 5+ years, Node has gotten much more popular, which makes more client-side.
Node is a server that is written in JavaScript that helps you run JavaScript. The benefit of it is now your whole stack, your whole website, from what the customers, the people who come to your website see, to the actual server side that is handling all the requests, can all be in one language.
And now we're really nerding out.
Yeah.
I think when I think about JavaScript, I think it's one of the only, you know, event-driven languages. And e-commerce is event-driven, right? So you add something to cart, you view a product, you place an order. All of those are events. And so for us, we can respond to those events in real time without page reloads.
Exactly.
And start to do interesting things with merchandising, pricing, promotions. And so I think what's happened, just trying to respond to the question, which is you've seen a significant increase in popularity in JavaScript and JavaScript frameworks like React and Angular, and whereas some of the more traditional languages, which I think are still great for different purposes, like PHP or Rails, are on the decline. You can just look at any chart right now and just see, in terms of popularity, there's just a big shift towards React and towards Node and towards JavaScript. And then, you know, going back to the evolution part, like, so yes, we are the new kids on the block. We're an early stage startup, but all the early adopters start to go towards a new technology because they want to be working on something that, you know, they enjoy working on, and they want to be working in kind of the tech stack that we've been built on. So that's why I think we're seeing the momentum. We're now one of the, I think, top 2 e-commerce platforms on GitHub, and you know, we're just a team of 15 right now. So it's definitely seen lots of interest just through those early developer communities.
Yeah. You just hit 1.0 a couple months ago, right? And that's a big deal. What does that mean? What is 1.0?
So we launched our version 1.0.0, our official general availability release, which is a marker to the world and to our community that we're now stable, ready for production usage. We already had shops running Reaction in production prior to that, but it was when we said we have the table stakes feature set and the stability of the code base to say, okay, we're now at 1.0. And it's also just how in open source and in tech, you kind of version control your software. We're already now, I think, at 1.2. Mm-hmm. We'll probably be at 2.0 by the end of the year. And so we continue to march on, but it's definitely a signal of readiness.
Because you guys have been building this for about 2.5 years or something like that?
Yeah, actually 3.5. So we started the company, co-founded it 3.5 years ago. We bootstrapped for the first 1.5 years. My co-founder and I just working from our homes and putting on our product hats and just building the core platform and really having a blast as product people. Raised some financing and really have, for the most part, kept pretty quiet as a company. The code has always been open source. And we like to say we're open source stealth. Mm-hmm. although that's changing now. We're starting to ramp up some marketing and more brand awareness, community evangelism, community meetups. But we're 3.5 years into it. Just felt like we were ready to unveil it, put the 1.0 on it, and did that last March.
Yeah, when you're building something that is so core to someone's business, there's a lot of pieces to that. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. It's hard to roll something out like a store in stages because you really need to have your products and your payments and your users and ways to update them. And then how that website looks. And it's very hard to do that in increments.
That's right. Yeah. And it's also, I think, touches on, when you really look at it, there's not that many overnight successes when you look at we're building a full stack e-commerce platform. So for us, it was the right thing to do to spend, several years building the core technology and really getting the platform in a place where we felt really comfortable, where the community was already contributing and adopting it. We're product people at our heart. So, we could probably just build for the rest of our lives. But we reached that milestone. We feel like we've got all the table stakes items you would need to run a production shop. It doesn't mean like we have, all the features checkboxed, marked off, continue to adopt and extend it, as will the community, right? Like we actually see ourselves not necessarily as the owners of the code, more as the shepherds of it, where we're architecting, obviously, we have a roadmap, we're maintaining, we're testing, security is really important. We're doing all of that kind of oversight. But we really see it as your code, as the community's code.
How do you reconcile that with the managed platform? Because it seems like it has to be hard to give the same level of flexibility to people while also selling them something that is sort of turnkey, or maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way.
We're still so early, so... I kind of laugh that no one's really mad at us yet, though it's not hard per se, because also like you have a choice.
Right.
Like you can use our managed platform, which is built for Reaction Commerce, obviously. So it has, ability to do deploys and multiple environments and rollbacks and roll forwards, all stuff that you probably could do if you're a DevOps person or, sophisticated enough to go do it yourself through AWS or Heroku. But ultimately what we found is people want ease. They want to be able to focus on their e-commerce shop or their marketplace and then leave all the other stuff to someone else. And that's us. So some percentage of people will do that and some percentage won't, right?
One of the things that is challenging, and I've seen this a few times over the years, I think the two examples that come to mind are probably Firefox and WordPress, where they both started with a philosophy of being very modular. But I think the users are always asking for more, and it's easier to add something than it is to remove it. And so you end up adding things into the core piece of software that actually turn out not to be essential to everyone. And you see that cycle over and over where a piece of software will move along and gradually become more and more bloated. And then some other company will step in and we're the one that is, we removed all the bloat. We're starting from scratch. And that's like a cycle that seems to happen, every decade or whatever with every major piece of technology. And so I see Reaction Commerce as like, we're the clean, everything's well organized, we figured it out. But how do you prevent the inevitable from happening?
Right. Well, I agree with you. I think there is that inevitable nature.
Yeah.
It's innovator's dilemma, or it's just another evolution and there's going to be something, a newer, better way to do something or build something that will come out, in 10, 12 years. I guarantee it. Like it's already happened in the 20 years that I've been in tech. You just keep seeing these like iterations and cycles. Investors ask us this question, really? who's going to replace you? And here's how I think about it. Like ultimately, I think it comes down to the DNA of the team.
Yeah.
We're nerds at our core. Like we like to be playing around with the new, fun, interesting technologies or devices or whatever comes out there. So like if there's ever going to be something that comes out that's new and shiny, like my team and myself, we're probably going to be the first ones to try to adopt it and use it. So it's like in our core of who we are is like almost our manifesto is like, okay, we don't want to be static. We want to continue to like redefine and continue. Now I say that now, like 10 years from now, yeah. 10 years from now, when we have hundreds of thousands of shops running on our platform and we have, you know, all these responsibilities, it may be easier said than done, but, you know, no one has a crystal ball. It's going to happen. I think ultimately we've tried as best we can in today's, you know, world to build a company and a team and processes and a technology platform that is customizable, that is extendable, that can be refactored. We've already probably refactored several times just in a short, you know, three and a half years, because there's a lot of change that's been happening within the JavaScript community. So I don't know. I mean, I'll be fascinated to kind of see it play out and kind of where it goes from here.
Well, it's interesting that you have the historical perspective of having seen this happen probably like three or four times over with a lot of the major platforms that have, you know, come about online. And, you know, we talked about Web 1.0 with, you know, GeoCities and some of the things that we were talking about with JavaScript. I think the early days of like Web 2.0 were about that discovery of everything was static. And yeah. Then we started to use JavaScript. And at the time, I remember when that stuff came out, people would call it Ajax. I don't even remember what Ajax stands for. I'm a dork also. I just would read all this stuff and it would always be like, there's a new Ajax powered like blogging engine and you can just write it and it's all, you know, WYSIWYG is also another term that would get thrown around a lot at the time, which is like what you see is what you get. You would be able to, you know, write a blog post and then save it and it would be in line. So all of that stuff would be happening kind of live in the browser. You know, a more layman's perspective on that is just that the web used to be more static and over time it's become more like an app. Yeah. And that trend has continued more and more. And the frameworks that you're talking about, React, Angular, are pushing more and more in that direction where everything is happening in real time. You talked about event-driven actions that are happening on a website, things you're trying to purchase something, you're trying to add something to your cart, all of that stuff is happening dynamically. If you have to use the crystal ball, like what's the next kind of thing that we need to do on the web to make it even more appy, or is there something after the app that we haven't thought about?
I would love to know. I mean, it's a really thoughtful question, and I think we're already seeing glimpses of it. It comes down to data and data-driven experiences, and hate to use buzzwords, but it's going to be around, you know, AI and really having kind of more intelligent apps that are based off of, you know, the data we know about each other and ourselves and, you know, trends. And I think that's what, you know, if we think about like why we even, like the vision of where we want to go and why we even called ourselves Reaction Commerce. It's an homage to Newton's third law. For every action, there should be an equal and opposite reaction. And that gets to data at the core. And so we can track all the events and all the data that's happening across our network of shops. So what are people looking at? What are people clicking on, viewing, where the mouse is? And I think that data becomes really important to be able to provide experiences beyond the app, which is, you know, personalization, which is, you know, really, really hard to do, and more personalized dynamic merchandising. Look, right now when you go to a shop, like there's not that much serendipity, especially at kind of the SMB or mid-market. It's a very static experience. You go to a shop, you and I would probably see the same thing, no matter if you were in another country and I was in the United States. Like, and that just doesn't make sense all the time because there's different weather. It's a different time of day. You know, you may have different interests. And so like, I think that type of data becomes really important to be able to serve more dynamic experiences, which ultimately, if I'm a business, hopefully will help to convert more visitors to my shop and to help them define what they're looking for, rather than like, you know, forcing them to look through large catalogs.
The idea of weather, for example, is a great example. You know, we live in Los Angeles. You can sell bathing suits all year round here. Whereas, you know, if I'm in New York at this time of year or somewhere else, I might not want to see that product, or I might want to see a different product. So you can imagine whatever company it is that is interested in selling different types of products, that experience could always get more personalized.
For the crystal ball, I mean, I think we'll get to that within the next, you know, the next generation or so. We'll get to more dynamic experiences. And it's only getting cheaper and easier to manage that level of data. And so right now, it may be only possible for companies with lots of capital, lots of resources, the Amazons of the world, kind of the Walmarts. But ultimately, it's going to get easier, easier, and easier for that data and those experiences to be translated to all businesses. And hopefully, that's through reaction commerce.
There's a lot of conversational stuff happening as well. You know, there's Intercom and other companies that are involved in putting like little chat functionality into the store and trying to create. And there's a lot of people trying to take that idea and apply bots to it, where like some sort of AI driven robot Siri type of experience is going to have a conversation with you. Alexa, like Amazon has this new thing now where you put the camera in your wardrobe and it looks at you and says like, hey, you should wear this other. I don't even know how that works. They have that new product that will tell you what to wear. All of these things kind of seem related and also kind of all seem a little bit, maybe not completely figured out. What's your take on it?
I would agree. I love watching the space and I'm kind of watching from the sidelines a little bit, kind of seeing how is it going to play out. I don't think it's figured out yet. I think kind of that conversational commerce, the chat bots, the kind of personal shoppers experience, but the experience isn't right yet. Mm. I always find it kind of disconnecting when I purchase something from a shop and then all of a sudden Facebook Messenger is like, whoa, thanks for your purchase. I'm like, well, how, you know, like I wasn't ready for that. Like there's still, I think, some gaps for the consumer experience to make it a little bit smoother. Yeah, I don't think it's figured out yet.
It's an interesting idea though, that with reaction commerce being open source and modular the way it is, that you could plug into that easily if you want to. So you don't really have to have an opinion about it at this point.
We can be Switzerland. We can be neutral. I mean, all our data is open, accessible. Someone will figure that out. I think voice is makes a lot of sense. I always like look to the offline world as like a guide. Mm. So I love walking into a shop and in certain cases where there's a personal shopper, personal assistant, someone who's just really friendly and helpful. Sometimes that's really nice. Now, I don't think that experience has yet been replicated online in a way that's not like intrusive and kind of like too in your face. We've all been to the shop where they are kind of an intrusive salesperson. Right. I think there's a way to do it. It just hasn't been created yet.
That's how I feel when I go to a website. It's very popular right now to have a little chat bubble in the bottom right corner. And you arrive on the website and it's right away like a little pop-up comes up that says like, hey, you know, if you need any help, I'm here. Hello.
Close.
Yeah, I find that very intrusive. It does feel like the salesperson who's a little bit too up in your face while you're just like browsing.
I think before that, you know, there was always you still see this a lot, the modal that pops up for your email to get a discount. And it almost feels like, whoa, that's too fast. Like we haven't even we haven't even talked yet.
I don't even know what you have to sell it here.
Like we don't even have a relationship yet. Yeah. So I think that will get figured out. That's kind of the first thing that happened. You have these chat bots, you have these modals, these windows that pop up. And I think it will get more and more integrated into the actual app, into the experience. So rather than just popping up in the right-hand corner, you might be like actually on a page and something will be embedded there and it won't be as like intrusive and you can interact with it when you want, not have to like close it. And that's where I think back to the JavaScript and Node, I think that's what can happen and you can do it really well.
A lot of these platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, they want to keep users on their platform. And so they're providing new ways that you can buy straight from their platform. Like you can, if I'm selling clothes, I can have my Facebook page and possibly sell right from there, or I can sell directly from Pinterest. And I know that some shops will create an integration where when that order happens, you know, it will go into your, presumably you guys have something like that, it will go right into your reaction dashboard or something like that. It's putting the e-commerce experience inside of somebody else's platform. And that seems to be probably happening more and more. Those platforms are hungry to grab that if they can.
And I think that's only natural. I think, you know, you know, Web 1.0 was kind of one-to-one. You know, I went to a shop and, right, you know, that was the experience. There wasn't all these like social platforms that are out there today. And then it's one-to-many. Like I went to many shops and now it's everywhere, right? Like you can't escape it. It's whether it's on Pinterest, you're in a kind of more of a content-like experience or media, and you want to shop. So I think I'm all for putting commerce in as many places and for us to be able to power that kind of as, right, as the back end and as the system for, you still have to manage your catalog. You still have to manage the orders. You still have to figure out taxes and shipping. And you still ultimately want to have your own branded shop. We saw this on Etsy all the time. So Etsy, you know, significant marketplace, a platform, Etsy sellers, as they started to grow, wanted to sell elsewhere, mm-hmm, and wanted to sell in their own shops or in, you know, other avenues. I mean, Amazon Marketplace, which a lot of people don't really know, Amazon has hundreds of thousands of sellers. Right. So I think for us, for Reaction, we have to be able to provide and make it possible for you to syndicate your products to,
yeah,
wherever your audience is. And more, that's external, that's on other platforms, as well as why you build up your own brand and people come directly to you.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm a Pinterest user, and I think that's what Pinterest would say, I'm just browsing, I'm looking at all these different clothes, let's say, and there's something that is interesting to me, it's great to be able to have a single shopping experience where I'm used to the Pinterest interface. I don't have to go and figure out each different website's cart system and checkout system and payment solution and whatever. The flip side of that is, what is your opinion about how to create like a destination online? What are the ways that you can be a good enough website that you can get people to come to you and want to shop on your website?
So I think part of it is about the website itself. And I think Lumi does this really well. And you just see a lot of the direct-to-consumer brands that really have built up really clean, kind of authentic, another overused word. Mm. But what does that mean? Really like clean, simple content, the voice, the messaging is just all spot on. So they're creating these websites or these, you know, mobile experiences that just feel good. And their product imagery is really well done. The shopping cart, just, you want to shop there. It's like walking into a coffee shop or a place. You're like, oh, this feels good. I want to move in here. But I think that you can't just do that and say, I'm done. Because then you have to put yourself out there. You have to create a brand. And part of that is content. And part of that is putting yourself out there on other platforms and getting your message out. And that, I think, is where that marketing side and the content marketing, social marketing, especially for e-commerce brands, is really, really challenging.
Yeah. I feel resistant to the idea of just the words we're using feel so vague. And so I'm trying to pinpoint, what is it that these brands, and we're talking about, you know, companies that come to mind like Everlane or Warby Parker, those types of companies that have been able to build enough of a brand, create enough of a compelling user experience that they bring people over. And you're right, some of it is as simple as having really good photography. That's something that we come across all the time because we sell a product that is very much a commodity. So we think a lot about, how do we take a nice photo of a box, of a cardboard box? And that sounds dumb, but it's actually
really
one of
important.
The things that is actually one of the hardest pieces of our business is taking good photos of boxes and making those look consistent and making sure that the craft paper color isn't all over the place as you are like scrolling through lots of different images of different craft colored products. So that is a difficult challenge. And it seems straightforward, like, hey, hire a photographer, but it's actually not.
It's not at all. And, you know, again, back to my Etsy days, you know, we spent a lot of time building up training and materials and education for our sellers to be able to take good photography, and did a lot of meetups around that. And so, I mean, I think that's one aspect. I think some of the brands we're talking about have come at the market with better pricing in some cases, or have kind of cut out the middleman, so to speak, and tell a story of, you know, going direct. And I think just like like anything, the pendulum shifted from these big box retailers where everything was very mass produced. And you're starting to see some shift towards wanting things a little bit more handcrafted, or what's the story behind how this is made. And you see that, I think, with Everlane or with Warby or some of the other brands that are out there that are direct to consumer, that are really like, you want to feel good about what you're wearing or eating or consuming. And so you see lots of different startups in all those areas starting to take off.
You mentioned Etsy. What was your role there? How did you get involved with Etsy?
Sure. So at Etsy, I was the vice president of product. So I oversaw all product design and content. I was there, 7 or 8 years ago, kind of the first wave of team members who were brought in kind of post-founding to really help to scale the product and the company and really build up what was already an incredible brand, an incredible company, had a lot of great momentum, but just put a little bit more people and processes and start to really scale both the seller experience as well as the buyer experience. So I always like to say when I joined Etsy, when you search for jewelry, which was the most popular category by far, the site would crash.
Wow.
And so here's Etsy raised, millions of dollars, a darling brand, great company, great team, but struggling to scale with the volume. And so one of the first projects I worked on as VP of product, along with the engineering team, was to replace the search and build out a whole new search infrastructure.
What's your take on what's happening to Etsy now? There was some news recently. They've since then gone public. They're a company, like you said, that is a darling of the industry. And I think a lot of it has to do with what their mission started with as, being this marketplace for handmade goods. And over time, there's the pressures of being a public company really is difficult. I don't know. The most recent stuff is that they have these activist investors who are coming in and trying to nudge Etsy in different directions, trying to maybe have it focus less on perks for its employees and grow its revenue in ways that maybe are not quite in sync with the philosophy of the company, trying to move away from the B Corp status, which Etsy had worked towards or is, still as a B Corp. I don't think we've ever actually really delved deep into that on the podcast yet, but it's an interesting aspect of Etsy's culture and a lot of interesting other companies. What do you make of all of that?
I really believe in what Etsy has created and kind of the movement around makers and the do-it-yourself aesthetic. So I'm absolutely rooting for Etsy and the company. I think there's a fundamental flaw in the public markets around a company like Etsy. And if you think about it, maybe, at least the way it's structured today, where you have, you can have activist investors who are able to, make these demands. And I don't know the whole story at all. I'm rooting for a company like Etsy to be able to be public and to be able to have real values that speak to how employees are treated or how work culture looks and what the office looks like. All that to me makes total sense. And I'd want to invest in that because you're investing in people and then you're investing in this marketplace or this platform that supports, multi-millions of sellers and people. To me, that makes sense. Now, the economics behind it and the way the public markets today work probably doesn't make sense. I don't think that's Etsy's fault. I think that's a limitation of the public markets, personally.
It's something that you have to consider for your business as well, having taken investment. Lumi, I think of ourselves as a platform as well. Even, we're a store in some ways, but we also consider ourselves a platform. And I think when you are a platform, whether it's Etsy or Reaction Commerce or Lumi, you have to be optimistic about the future to be in this business because you're trying to empower a whole community of people who are doing that. So it's fundamentally an optimistic perspective on the world. I guess the question that's in there is, how do you remain optimistic and how do you reconcile that with taking investment? Maybe those are two completely different questions, but
they're probably related. Yeah. If I really thought about it, I think you're right. Optimism is incredibly important. I think entrepreneurs, you have to have this almost, insane, fanatical sense of optimism. And that, again, going back to like at our core, I think that's in our DNA that we are optimistic about where commerce is and where it's going and what the potential is for e-commerce and growth around the world. And I think we'll play a meaningful part of that. Now, how that translates to us having investors and, you know, what that means for us as a company, whether we are independent or on a path towards, who knows, acquisition or public. Again, crystal ball needs to come out. Yeah. And who knows where that will lead us. And sometimes there can be friction in those, right? There can be friction in those outcomes. And, you know, I think it's my job as CEO and job of our team is to really be honest to both our investors and to our community and to the people that we serve. And I think going back again, we're open source. So the code is out there for the community to have and to be able to access, regardless of the status of what our company is or the trajectory that we're on.
Yeah. It's one thing to be optimistic. You can be personally optimistic. You can convince your team to be personally optimistic. You can get a handful of investors to do that. Once you go public, every level becomes harder and harder to like convince all of these people that you're generally onto something and that's the wave that we're trying to ride.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And I think that is, I think it's a good analogy that at each different level, there's going to be different responsibilities and different threats and different kind of needs from both investors, employees, team members, the community. I would expect that. I mean, we've already in our short evolution, you know, already have more and more, you know, community needs and responsibilities to up our level of whatever it is, communication. We're now doing these live stream meetups and just to be more out there with how we're building the product, how we're communicating about the product and the roadmap. And I think that you're right. It only gets exponential from right. here.
What is it in your mind that makes you optimistic about the future of e-commerce, let's say?
So I think, you know, I think what gets me excited day in and day out is really just the small stories. It's like just a couple of weeks ago, an art marketplace went live on Reaction Commerce and they're built in the UK. They already support, I think, 20 languages and they're building a marketplace for artists to sell their artwork. And it's one of the first real big examples of a marketplace built on our platform. And we worked really closely with the team and the kind of the lead there. And it just felt like really good to be able to support like on that small level, this small business trying to make it, you know, trying to build this new next gen innovative art marketplace. And we're seeing stories like that crop up all the time. And what I love about it is that it's happening around the world. There was a Samsung distributor in Bolivia that popped up on Reaction Commerce. There's just little stories. So I'm optimistic. I mean, there are millions upon millions of shops and ideas out there that need software or need a way to get created. And I hope that we can be a part of that experiences of businesses taking an idea and building it into something meaningful. I'm optimistic that it's only going to get bigger from here. I mean, I'm no expert in terms of this, but I, you know, you look at kind of all what all the analysts are saying and kind of where the growth is that technology is not going to go away and e-commerce is only going to continue to grow year over year. And the number of people who are shifting online from offline is also just continuing to grow, but it's also still so early, right? Yeah. So it's like there's all this potential of more people coming online, more people purchasing online. And that gives me the optimism like, okay, yeah, we can actually fuel some of this. We can actually be a part of providing retailers and brands really great software to be able to build unique businesses.
Yeah, for the most part, commerce is still, I think the stats are like 90% offline. And so even maybe among the people who are listening to this podcast, it's very unevenly distributed.
Right.
We might be spending 90% of our dollars online, but that's not true for the rest of the world or even in America. And I think what you were saying earlier totally resonates with me as well, which is basically leveling the playing field. That's what the web has been doing the whole time. You know, if I get a domain and it's just, you know, myname.com, it's the same amount of placement as any other thing. Coca-Cola.com has, it's just a website on the internet and anyone can access it. And it, obviously different companies have different amount of money that they can spend getting people to come to them. But if I build my website on reaction commerce, I'm getting the same amount of great software into my experience as like the biggest company in the world.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're getting something and we could, it could be as powerful for a brand like Nordstrom or, you know, for a one person
business, yeah.
Business building, you know, a shop out of your garage. I think like one of the things, like if you go back to like my career and just the different threads through, you know, what I've done in tech is I love building things that empower the little guy, the kind of the David versus Goliath type stuff to be successful online. And that's where I get kind of the most satisfaction when I look back at those stories of like, wow, that was really cool. When I was at Yahoo, we'd go and visit Yahoo sellers, Yahoo store merchants in their businesses. And it was just really neat to see them like go from a garage to a warehouse to a brick and mortar location, all built on stuff that I had a hand in building. And you see that now with reaction commerce. And I think that's, I mean, the web is the great equalizer, right? Like we mm-hmm. can actually build technologies or platforms like it didn't exist before. You know, businesses didn't have access to the software. They had to start on smaller systems and move on up. Well, you don't have to do that anymore. There's no limitations. Like GeoCities was pre-cloud. Like, you know, like now there's a cloud. Okay. Now, you know, open source now is a really big accepted, adopted movement and all these things. And, you know, make it easier for any type of business, small or large, 10 products or a million products. It really doesn't matter to be able to succeed.
Yeah, that's been our philosophy on the packaging side is, can we create that same level of equalization, democratization, but in the physical world? And, you know, we haven't proven that out yet, but we're trying. But that's definitely what gets me out of bed, because then if you can get there, the ideas can compete more head to head. It's less about the marketing that you have or the and that's what also I love about a company like Kickstarter. We were big fans of Kickstarter early on, and that's another platform that allows you to do that in the fundraising area. But ideally, you get to this point where if more people can create something, more weird ideas will come out. And maybe some of those weird ideas are really good ideas that lots of people want. Or maybe some of them are just weird ideas that some people want, but that's enough to make a great business for whoever that is and the community of fans that are interested in that.
Yep. No, that's what I mean, that's what I love. And you know, it is part of why I think technology can neutralize that and can be that experience that gives any idea a chance to be successful, whether, again, small or large, weird or not weird. And it doesn't really matter about how much money you have or you know, in anything. It really is, you can speak, and the product can speak for itself, right?
I can't let you go without talking about Palm Springs.
I was hoping.
I got too into all this stuff. But, you know, last time you came over to Lumi and spoke, it was just a great thing. And we ended in the same place. And I just wanted to talk to you about that because you grew up there. And Jesse and I have like recently had a love affair with Palm Springs because we went there together for New Year's this past year. Like, and we went to Joshua Tree around there. And I'm a big fan of modernism and architecture and seeing that stuff. And Palm Springs is just like the epicenter of that. And since then, like Jesse bought a property in Joshua Tree. I don't even know if you know that.
I didn't.
Like 2 months after she went there, and she's like trying to, it's just a plot of land. She's going to try and build something there.
It's great.
It's very much experimental, but you probably have a completely different perspective on it having, you know, grown up there. What is it like being from there, I guess? I don't know. Maybe you take all of that stuff for granted. I don't know.
No, I think my perspective is similar. I have great appreciation for the desert, how beautiful it is, the architecture. It's definitely, you know, part of who I am. I'm fourth generation Palm Springs. So my parents are still out there. You know, my great grandfather homesteaded out in the desert and was a carpenter, so built a lot of the early homes in actual Palm Springs proper. And I really love it up there. Growing up there, it's a small community. You don't realize that there's, you know, my friends' parents were my parents' friends, and it's kind of this really tight-knit group. So it was really a fun place to grow up, a lot of outdoors, a lot of activities. And I think that's certainly what I still appreciate today is just outdoors and hiking and the desert and just the stark landscapes. And a lot of people don't realize, if you haven't been to Palm Springs, is that, you know, it's surrounded by these massive mountains, like, right, you know, the San Jacinto Mountains are, yeah, rise over 10,000 feet. And it's really an incredible place to grow up. And it's also only 2 hours from Los Angeles. So I think that's what you're experiencing, is that, yeah, it's this great weekend getaway. And Joshua Tree has a whole nother set of just, you know, amazing landscape and just obviously climbing with the park. And so, yeah, it's definitely a part of who I am and something I really cherish. I think it's a special spot. I think you have the combination of, you know, amazing weather. You know, it obviously gets insanely hot in, yeah, in the summer, but we always like to say it's a dry heat. You know, it's yeah, it's really a comfortable climate year round. And then, yeah, you've got, like you said, you got this amazing culture, music, and architecture and art. It's also really close to Los, yeah, Angeles, and so you get this easy kind of weekend getaway spot for a lot of people, whether you like the outdoors or you like sporting or you know, you just like architecture. So there's a lot of things to do for families, for people of all ages.
Is there anything else lately that you've been kind of enjoying discovering, whether it's like exhibitions or, I don't know, books you've read, podcasts you're listening to, things you're watching come to mind at all?
Nothing's really come into my mind. For me, I've been really more conscious this year about spending more time outdoors, just personally.
Yeah.
And that could be as simple as taking the scenic route home. So just riding my bike along the beach path to get home, or, you know, getting to the beach with my dog and spending more time outdoors. Like, for me, that's like where I get fulfilled. And I think, like, if anything I tell kind of my team and friends, it's like, it's so easy to let that stuff go. Especially as an entrepreneur, and like, I'd found myself just feeling like we all get, you know, tired and, you know, burnt out. And so for me, just spending more time experiencing hiking in Malibu, yeah, or going up to Joshua Tree, or, yeah, experiencing the world, or, you know, obviously been listening to your podcast.
Oh, wow. Oh, thank you.
binge listening, I think I told you.
But what you were saying before, I think resonates with a lot of people. I think everyone's like feeling, you know, like they're getting more screens in their life than ever before. And it's like, wait a minute, what am I doing all day?
Right.
I think that feels like a very zeitgeist like moment in time right now, where I'm hearing that from a lot of people.
Yep.
So you got to get out there.
One of the books I go to regularly, and I actually just recommended it this week, so why it's top of mind, is Nonviolent Communication. I don't know if it's one that you're familiar with. It's one I actually, you know, have it at home and at office. It's one I pick up just regularly, just about like communicating in very non-threatening ways to people of diverse personalities. And it's something like I love focusing on. I love team dynamics. I love interpersonal communication. I love trying to create spaces for people of all cultures and to be their best. So I don't know, that one just came to my mind.
What are some of the ideas from that book? What did they say?
It's going to sound kind of obvious when I'm saying it, because it's really like kind of more nuanced in the way it's described in the book. But it is about providing space for listening. It is about providing space for reflection and not constantly having to fill voids with words. And I mean, look, you go to almost any meeting, there's always, you know, different personalities at play. There's someone who might be talking more than just kind of someone who's talking less. And it's really, as a leader and as a manager, and kind of like what I'm trying to hone in on as we grow our team, is creating that spot for people to feel comfortable to speak up and to facilitate those meetings. Like, meetings don't just happen. Yeah. Good meetings actually are facilitated in ways that bring out different ideas. So that's a whole nother podcast. It's a whole nother podcast, right? Because we could talk about that, because I think that's really an art and a science.
Yeah, I was always the shy person in school, you know, growing up. And I just had an experience like that yesterday, where we were, you know, having a big team meeting, and one of our interns who's a little bit more shy, she just had like so many really good questions. And she's very smart, but doesn't always like maybe have the courage to ask that question. And those are things that you need to facilitate somehow. I want to read that book, because it's making me think that I should promote that more somehow in the meetings.
I think it's important. Yeah. I think it's really important in all areas, certainly in tech. And I mean, that's, you know, whether it's, you know, an intern versus kind of a C-level executive or a woman versus a man or, you know, different cultures who communicate differently. It's definitely an area where I know I have a lot to learn, and I'm just fascinated by this topic. The data is there, like the more diverse the team and the more diverse opinions there are, the more likely you are to be successful and to have a really good business. So I love geeking out on that stuff.
Well, we'll have to geek out on that sometime soon when you become a regular on the podcast.
Count me in.
In the meantime, people can go to your new website. You guys redid the whole branding and everything too, right?
That's right.
What's the URL for that?
So we're at reactioncommerce.com.
And you should go to GitHub, star it, favorite that. If you want to follow Reaction Commerce, or I know that you post on your blog pretty regularly as well.
My blog is Sarah Lou Hicks, all one word, and that's Sarah without an H. So sarahlouhicks.com.
We'll have the links in there.
And I'm Sarah Lou Hicks on Twitter, and certainly find me through Reaction Commerce. You said GitHub and all the usual places.
Cool. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.